Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo. And tonight we, we're going to have some news and views. But our interview tonight is with Leila Brun and Ghana exchange student Mohammed Adouala. And they discussed the importance of the program, of the exchange program, which is the YES program, and the significance of Arab-American relations.
Yes, it's mostly with the students come from mostly Muslim
this
nations.
This program is all Muslim nations. They target Arab or Muslim students.
Muslim students, because the program was founded after 9/11.
Yeah.
It's a very competitive program, and it's really preparing these students to take their place in their country in the international community, I think.
But also they go back as and
as ambassadors.
Yeah, they're ambassadors to this country, but they're also they go back and to develop careers in either government or some leadership role in their own countries. And they're all our guest tonight. Mohammed, he's 18 years old. He's a senior in, at Mount Everett High School in Sheffield, Massachusetts. And he's a very, very nice guy.
He's very charming.
A student and
hard worker.
Yeah. So we're happy to have him on, and he explains the his own culture shock and a lot of interesting
his
aspects
story.
Too. Yeah. So I hope you'll enjoy this. It's a little different kind of interview than we usually have, but I think you'll enjoy it. To start things off,
we'll give a little news.
You want to read that? Yeah,
yeah.
I love that article. I thought this is the first time I've seen military uses that could possibly transfer over into
this is from discovery.com. Stronger, faster, and harder is the promise of a new exoskeleton developed by Lockheed Martin for U.S. soldiers, dubbed the Human Universal Load Carrier, or HULC. The device helps the soldier carry up to 200 pounds at a top speed of 10 miles per hour. The soldier has the feeling of maybe an extra 5 to 10 pounds, said Doug Metcalf, business development manager at Lockheed Martin. Today, some soldiers are carrying loads of up to 130 pounds into combat. Unlike most exoskeletons built to boost human ability, the HULC, which Metcalf says does not owe its name to the popular green comic book carrier, isn't limited to the length of its power cable. The titanium I guess it's called the Hulk.
Really?
Yeah.
Where is it?
HULC.
Yeah, Hulk.
Hulk. I was calling it Hulk.
Hulk.
The titanium Hulk instead runs on four lithium-ion batteries nestled into the small of a soldier's back. Eight batteries can power the Hulk on missions up to 96 hours. The Hulk is easy to put on, its makers report. It arrives folded into a small package. The soldier stretches a leg out and steps into footbeds underneath the boot. Straps wrap around the thigh, waist, and shoulders. The footpads ensure that the weight from the soldier's load rests directly on the ground, not on the soldier's body. Inside the footpads are pressure relay information about the speed and walking style of the soldier to an onboard computer. The computer's artificial intelligence moves the hydraulic system to amplify and enhance the movement. The Hulk allows the soldier to walk, run, kneel, and crawl, among other things. It can impede other movements, however, but if a soldier comes under fire and needs more flexibility, the Hulk can be removed in about 30 seconds. Wounded soldiers could be evacuated easier by other Hulk-equipped soldiers, Lockheed says. Retreating soldiers could deny the enemy equipment that today would have to be left behind because of its heft. The Hulk comes at a critical time. U.S. Army reports that 20,000 soldiers are classified as non-deployable. Half of those were injured during battle. The other half cannot be deployed because of physical problems such as inability to haul heavy loads. Hulk wasn't created to reduce injuries, but if it does reduce injuries along the way, that is positive for the war. Metcalf said they could design an exoskeleton that could carry more weight, but they don't expect their customers will need to carry more than 200 pounds at once. As a product of millions of years of evolution, the human body is naturally good at moving around, said Aaron Dahler, a professor of mechanical engineering at Yale University. Any attempt to improve on nature's design is a difficult engineering challenge. Walking is one of the things that the human body is most efficient at, said Dahler. Anytime something is really good, like human walking, it is hard to improve it. But that's wonderful that they'll be able to carry heavier loads, maybe get more people out of the injured people back to safety.
No, I think it's great, but also you can see commercial
maybe some
use for that too. I mean, on all kinds of things where people need to
be able to lift heavier loads.
Yeah, I mean, construction or anything. If you have that ability, you know, you really you reduce injury and you increase, you know.
Maybe you can read that one. The printing is small.
Oh.
I couldn't read it.
Yeah, I don't know if anybody's aware of Lieberman. Lieberman, who's made the foreign minister of the Israeli of Israel, but he's a real piece of work. And this guy's a
not
real
a
schmucko.
Nice man.
But this guy also advocated that all 13-year-old Palestinians should be murdered. And what kind of country is Israel if they put a guy like this in charge of their foreign ministry?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, that advocates complete and utter genocide of a population. And this guy is a criminal piece of crap. But listen to this. Yeah, Lieberman likely to be convicted. Israeli investigators say a corruption probe about foreign minister is likely to convict him of money laundering, fraud, and breach of trust. The investigation into the crimes allegedly committed by the Yisrael Bitnu leader Avigdor Lieberman is nearing an end. Haaretz on Saturday quoted Israeli police source as saying, the sources noted that the police could submit their recommendations on filing an indictment in upcoming weeks. Israeli investigators are collecting more testimony to charge him with bribery as well, as according to the sources. The remarks come after a team of the Israeli investigators questioned Lieberman for 5 hours on Friday. The Israeli foreign minister's bank accounts have been scrutinized, and he is asked to describe the origin of his money. Lieberman was first questioned on the matter in April 2007. I mean, this guy was under investigation and still was in the government, and later became the dickhead of the Israeli government. And sources of Israel declared the party would not quit the government even if Lieberman is forced to withdraw from the governing coalition. Huh. So it's like, you know, it's pretty sick shit. It's pretty sick stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that a criminal and a thief and a child murderer, okay, could be appointed to such a position. I mean, it tells you what kind of country Israel is, what kind of leaders they have. So let's go. I don't know why we're still supporting them. Swear to God.
The Washington Post report calls CIA detainee treatment inhuman by Joby Warwick and Julie Tate. This is WashingtonPost.com. Medical officers who oversaw interrogations of terrorism suspects in CIA secret prisons committed gross violations of medical ethics, in some cases essentially participated in torture. The International Committee of the Red Cross concluded in a confidential report that labeled the CIA program inhuman. Health personnel offered supervision and even assistance as suspected al-Qaeda operatives were beaten, deprived of food, exposed to temperature extremes, subjected to waterboarding. the relief agency said in the 2007 report, a copy of which was posted on a magazine website yesterday. The report quoted one medical official as telling a detainee, "I look after your body only because we need you for information." The confidential report sheds light on the CIA's handling of the detainees who were held in secret overseas prisons for up to 4 years and subjected to what agencies described as enhanced interrogation techniques. In addition to widely reported methods such as waterboarding, the report alleges that several of the detainees were forced to stand for days in painful positions with their arms shackled overhead. One prisoner reported being shackled in this manner for 2 to 3 months, 7 days of prolonged stress standing, followed by 2 days of being able to sit or lie down. In addition to the coercive methods, which the ICRC said amounted to torture and a violation of U.S. and international treaty obligations, the report said detainees were routinely threatened with further violence against themselves and their families. 9 of the 14 prisoners said they were threatened with electric shocks, infection with HIV, sodomy of the detainee, and being brought close to death, it said. Oh, that's disgraceful. Just disgraceful. An ICRC spokesman confirmed the authenticity of the document and said the organization deplores that what was to be a confidential report has been made public. The CIA declined yesterday to comment on the report, citing the Red Cross's own policy of maintaining the confidentiality of its reports. But spokesman Mark Mansfield noted that the agency had long since ended the controversial interrogation program. Director Leon Panetta has taken decisive steps to ensure that the CIA abides by the president's executive orders. That means the CIA will not use interrogation techniques outside the Army field manual, he said. He noted that Panetta had also stated repeatedly that no one who took action based on legal guidance from the Department of Justice at the time should be investigated, let alone punished. The presence of medical personnel at CIA interrogation sites had been reported previously. But ICRC investigators found that their participation in some of the more harsh episodes to be a severe breach of medical ethics. The report said the officials were enlisted to ensure that the detainees did not die or suffer irreparable damage. You can access this report at www.nybooks.com/icrc-report.pdf.
Okay.
If you'd like to.
Yeah, this one. This is just a follow up kind of to that, but this is more of a. This is from McClatchy's Washington Bureau. The Justice Department improperly withheld important psychiatric records of government witness. Of a government witness who was used in a significant number of Guantanamo cases. A federal judge has concealed. The government censored part of the records, but enough has been made public that it's clear that the witness, a fellow detainee, was being treated weekly for a serious psychological problem and was questioned about whether he had any suicidal thoughts. And the witness provided information in the government's case for detaining Aman Seed Bakhtarfi, a Yemeni doctor, who the government announced last week it would no longer seek to detain. In a little noticed ruling last week, Judge Emmett Sullivan found that the witness testimony in other cases would be challenged as unreliable. During a hearing last week, Sullivan castigated the government for not turning over the medical records and ordered department lawyers to explain why he shouldn't cite them for contempt of court. To hide relevant and exculpatory evidence from counsel and from the court under any circumstances, particularly here, where there is no other means to discover this information, and where the stakes are so very high, is fundamentally unjust, outrageous, and will not be tolerated, Sullivan said, according to a transcript of the hearing. How can this court have any confidence whatsoever in the United States government to comply with its obligations and to be truthful to the court? It also has criticized the government for deciding at the last minute to drop the case against Batarfi, who's been held at Guantanamo for 7 years and questioned its motives for doing so. He suggested that the government's announced plan to seek a country that would take Batarfi were really just a scheme to continue to detain him without due process. And the judge says, I'm not going to let this case drag on or any of the other cases on my calendar indefinitely while the government embarks on what is called its diplomatic process, because I have seen in the past that the diplomatic process can indeed span months and years, and I have some serious concerns as to whether it's yet and still another ploy to continue with this deprivation of this of his fair day in court. Sullivan threatened to have the government attorneys return to court in 14 days to report on the progress of freeing Batarfi, and every 14 days thereafter. I'm not going to continue to tolerate indefinite delay on the part of the United States government, Sullivan said. I mean, this Guantanamo issue is a travesty, a horror story, and I'm not going to buy into any extended indefinite delay of this man's stay at Guantanamo. Court records appear to indicate that the witness had an antisocial personality disorder. In a legal brief, Batarfi's lawyers point out the diagnosis could mean the person is prone to lying and lacks regard for the difference between right and wrong. Of course, you get that under torture. You know what I mean? You're going to get that under torture. Anybody who's tortured is going to lie like hell to stop being tortured. And Sullivan, however, was skeptical of the government's explanation and warned that someone's going to pay a price for not disclosing information. Sanction's going to be high, he said. I tell you, quite frankly, if I have to start incarcerating people to get my point across, I'm going to start at the top. Coincidentally, Sullivan presided over the corruption trial of former Alaska Republican Ted Stevens and was similarly critical of the Justice Department handling of the evidence in that case. Attorney Eric Holder recently asked the judge to dismiss the indictment against Stevens after concluding prosecutors withheld important evidence from the case. And the discovery of the records in Batarfi's case raised larger questions about the quality of the government's Guantanamo witnesses and whether the government has fulfilled legal requirements to provide the detainees' lawyers with evidence that could clear their clients. I mean, you know, nobody has been, there's only one trial, one conviction, I think, of any of these Guantanamo
people. Oh,
it's
crazy.
Yeah, it's absurd, you know. So, fortunately, it's going to close it down.
I'm so glad they're closing that down and return those people to their homes.
Yeah, the problem is they have to. I don't know why you can't do it now. But we got all that. Okay, you read that right? Report called CIA detaining treatment on human.
Yeah,
you read that right? Yeah. All right.
From the International Daily News, six gay men confirmed killed in Iraq. Iraq officials say six gay men, at least two of them in their teens, have been killed this past week. The two gay men killed in Baghdad's Saada City slum, and police said they had found the bodies of four more clerics after clerics urged a crackdown on the perceived spread of homosexuality. There may be even more victims of the Iraqi militia. Some Iraqi websites are showing photos of other bodies thought to be victims of police and death squads who were killed because of their sexual identity. Human rights campaigner Peter Tatchell recently told the UK's Guardian newspaper about the plight of Iraq's gay and lesbian citizens. Queens are being shot in their homes, streets, and workplaces. Even suspected gay children are being murdered. The killers claim to be doing these assassinations in the behest of the democratic Iraqi government in order to eradicate what they see as immoral, un-Islamic behavior, he explains. The program of targeted murders has one aim, according to the death squads, the total eradication of all queers from Iraq. It is, in effect, a form of sexual cleansing. The killers boast the most sodomites have already been eliminated.
Okay. Now, you don't want to be gay in Iraq.
I guess not.
That was Iraq, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, this is the last one here. Liberty Central's Civil Liberties, Villain of the Week, the Pentagon's privileged review team. Lawyers from Reprieve faced a jail sentence after officials from the U.S. Department of Defense had the nerve to complain about their unprofessional conduct. Lawyers from Binyam Mohammed for Binyam Mohammed faced the incredible prospect of 6 months jail sentence in America after writing a letter to President Obama detailing their client's allegations of torture by U.S. agents. The privileged review team, officials from the U.S. Department of Defense who monitor the censor communication between Guantanamo prisoners and their lawyers, have previously been accused of using their powers to suppress evidence of the abuse and mistreatment of detainees. Clive Stanford Smith, director of legal charity Reprieve, and his colleague Ahmed Ghaffour have been summoned to appear before a Washington court on May 11th after a complaint was made by the privileged review team. Stanford Smith had written to the president after judges in the UK ruled against release of U.S. evidence detailing Mohammed's alleged torture at Guantanamo. The letter asked the president to reconsider the U.S. position and urge him to release the evidence into the public domain. He attached a memo summarizing the case because his U.S. security clearance gives him access to the classified material. In order to comply with the classification guidelines, the memo did not identify individual officers by name or specify locations of the abuse. He and Ghaffour submitted the memo to the privileged team for clearance, but the memo was redacted to just the title, leaving the president unable to read it. And Stafford Smith included that the redacted copy of the memo in his letter to illustrate the extent to which it had been censored. He described it as a bizarre reality. You, as commander-in-chief, are being denied access to material that you would help prove, that would help prove that crimes have been committed by U.S. personnel. This decision is being made by the very people you command. And the privileged team argue that by releasing the redacted memo, Reprieve has breached the rules of that govern Guantanamo lawyers and have made a complaint to the court of unprofessional conduct. Stafford Smith described their action as intimidation, saying the complaint doesn't even specify the rules supposedly breached. So, you know, Obama's—they're editing everything out before Obama gets it.
Yeah.
All right, and Obama can't even rule on the damn thing. He's got to ask people what the hell this is all about.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, the Pentagon's privileged review team.
Yeah.
So these guys in Guantanamo, man, they're in limbo.
Horrible people.
Hell in limbo, I tell you. But,
no.
Yeah, so did you have anything else you wanted to read? We got about 5 minutes for the interview, but we can go right to the interview.
Yeah, we could probably go right to the interview.
Yeah. Actually, if you want to just mention the countries there that are involved.
The YES is a Youth Exchange Study Program. That's what YES stands for.
Yeah.
Youth Exchange Study Program in... let's see, the major countries are, not
announced. Yeah,
what is
it?
In one of these.
I lost that brochure.
Yeah, you don't know. Well, I know that they're Thailand, Egypt.
Indonesia.
Egypt, India.
Ghana.
And Ghana.
And,
those are the major,
others.
Yeah.
Several other countries that are involved with this program, and they select Muslim students Mohammed will explain it, and his coordinator will explain how.
And really, what it is promoting real peace through high school exchange.
Right.
Students who participate in the YES program are selected in an open merit-based competition conducted by AFS partner organizations in the countries where the students live. The three-tiered process includes a written application, an in-person interview, and a final screening by the National Selection Committee. Students who are accepted are provided a full scholarship to study in the United States. And YES students share their host families' everyday lives, engage in school activities, and volunteer in their communities. They learn about American society and values while educating Americans about their customs and culture in their homelands. The YES program focuses on leadership training. Staff and volunteers work with students to help them develop their leadership skills. When the students return home, they draw upon their U.S. experience and share their knowledge and memories in a way that helps to increase intercultural awareness while dispelling myths and stereotypes that often exist about the U.S.
Okay. So we're going to have that interview right now. We're going to bring it up, and this is... Lilia, I believe, Bruin, that's pronounced her name, correct? And Ghana exchange student, Muhammad Aduwala. And he will be very articulate. I think you're going to enjoy the interview. So it's about 30 minutes, so please enjoy.
Yeah, he did a great job. He's a wonderful guy.
Okay, so here we go.
$33 trillion.
I mean, how much is the value of
it?
Jane study, and it was a diplomacy initiative that came out of the events of 9/11.
I have to apologize. I overwhelmed it a little bit. I thought it was right there, but we're not. So if you can just hold on a second, I will cue this up a little better. Okay, this interview starts a little off, so we're going to excuse the shortcut there in the beginning.
An opportunity that they had used several times before, both in the 80s with a program called Congress Bugastack, and a program in the 90s called FLEX, Future Leaders of Exchange, and they created this program called YES, Y-E-S. And that program came fully into effect in 2003 with exchange students coming to the United States from several different countries with students who had an orientation where in their country there was a significant population that was Muslim. And so the students compete in a open, merit-based program over a six-month period. So in the case of Muhammad, who is a senior at Mount Everett, he can explain how he actually heard about the program. In different countries, students may hear about it through a newspaper or a teacher. In some countries where we may be working, such as Afghanistan, it may not be for safety, security reasons, that we can openly advertise in those ways. But we're looking for students who, leadership-wise, will be able to come here and share about their countries and their experience and likewise take back a better sense of understanding of our country and have an opportunity to see democracy, volunteerism, and free enterprise and be able to come back to developing countries and put those concepts into play.
Very good.
Okay, Mohammed, we want to go right to you. With this program, was this your very first trip to this country?
Yeah, this is actually my first trip outside my country, Ghana. And, you know, growing up, I never dreamed of traveling outside Ghana because, you know, I didn't have enough money. And then, you know, coming to the U.S. was a very big deal. And the only way I could do that is through this program, which was, you know, a full scholarship for a year. Yep.
You went through some grueling. You went through. There was 1,000 people that were selected for this program in your country, and you had to pass the test too.
Yeah. This is what they do. In Ghana, we have 10 regions. Like we have 50 states in the U.S. And what they do is each year they have students from at least 4 regions coming to the U.S. And so my year was students from Greater Accra, students from Volta region, and then students from Central region. And it was a very, very tough, you know, tough exam, you know. I didn't hear of it through the newspapers, even though it was published on the papers. But one time I was in class and the head teacher just you know, came in and announced the program, talk about the program, and
change your reality.
And I decided to give it a try, but you know, I wasn't so sure that I could come to the U.S. because it was such a big deal. But you know, I gave it a try, and we went for the exams. When we got there, you know, at the exam center, we had, you know, thousands of people just in my region alone. And when I saw them, I said to myself, this is impossible. Why are you here? And luckily, you know, after 2 or 3 weeks, we had a letter from a program to my school saying that I was one of those who have been selected. But then we have to go through an interview, you know. And that was my second interview. The first one was for a presidential award, which I didn't win. And so that gave me some experience on as to how to go about interviews. And when I got there, I was very nervous. And after the interview, I wasn't so sure that I would be selected. But, you know, after 3 weeks, I was informed that, yes, I was selected to go to the U.S. But even with that, I wasn't so sure because even... But during those period, I didn't tell my parents, my actual parents, because they were living in the countryside whilst I was schooling in high school in the city. So I didn't want to disappoint them. So I didn't even tell them until, you know, it was like certain that we're going to the U.S. when I told them, hey, Mom, I'm going to the U.S.
Yeah. How did she take it? What was her response?
You know,
she must have been thrilled, yeah.
Yeah, everybody, you know, the U.S. is a dreamland for everybody in Africa or in Ghana. And so, you know, when they heard that, everybody in my family was very happy and tears of joy and stuff.
Yeah.
You must feel a large responsibility, though, Muhammad. I mean, to be chosen like that and to come here, what expectations have for you?
You're part of it. You're actually on a diplomatic mission in many ways, aren't you not?
Yeah. It's more or less representing your country, and I respect my country and love it very much, and I think I'll do all it takes to, you know, raise the flag of my country very high, and above all, you know, I'll tell the American people that, you know, Islam is a religion of ideas, not, you know, something built on terrorism and stuff, and, you know, share my culture with American people, let them learn from them while they learn from me, and I believe I have responsibility to myself and to, you know, those who made this journey come true. You know, my parents, they spent a lot. You know, when somebody goes to the U.S., back in Ghana or in Africa, they expect to come back, you know, very rich. Come back with a white lady.
In a sports car, right?
Yeah. But, you know, that would be a tough challenge, you know, trying to explain to them that I just came to school or came to learn and then teach, but I didn't come here right now to work on, and, you know, that would be a tough challenge.
Yeah.
Because that's been your perception about America and all those who have been to America.
Yeah.
And
How were you prepared for your journey up here to your host's family? Did you have some orientation to this program before you were just sort of dropped into it?
I noticed that there was a 3-day orientation in Washington, D.C.
That's after we got here. That was in August. We met with all other students from all over the world in Washington, D.C. But in Ghana, after we were selected, we had 2 orientations. The first one was a week, and, you know, it was wonderful. We had so much to eat and drink, and by the time we returned home, we were very big, and our parents were like, come on, what did they feed you? Yeah, so the first orientation was like around March, and it took like a week, and we were camped somewhere, you know, in the city, and I met some other folks who were selected from different schools and different regions, and we were able to know each other. And then what we were told you know, how Americans behave and certain things you should know. Like you don't touch a guy whilst walking. You know, in Ghana you go hold the guy's hand and then walk with him. You know, it's normal. But here you can, you know, you can sit very close to a guy. Or so they're kind of like trying to, you know, explain to us how Americans behave. What do they expect? What will be very strange to them? And you know, well, there'll be some differences, but at least they're trying to let us know that this is what Americans are used to, and then this is how you're supposed to behave.
Well, you know, it's very interesting you mentioned that, because recently, Obama went over to Europe and he met at the G20 summit. He met the king of Saudi Arabia, or the minister. I'm not sure if it was the king or minister. But when Bush was involved with him, their families were big friends. Everywhere you saw, he and the king were holding hands. Okay, Bush was holding hands with him, and we thought that was very strange, and it was common.
For our culture, Bush was unusual.
Was friends with the Saudi family.
Mm-hmm.
But Obama was like, well, okay, you know, just shaking hands, and it was like a normal thing. And the Saudi king was just kind of like, you know, by his side. And I thought that was funny, because, I mean, Bush was so friendly with the guy, you know, they were walking hand in hand down.
Yeah,
it's a normal thing.
It's just a sign of friendliness. I mean, you can put your hand over the neck of your friend.
Well, you can
with
do that.
A guy, yeah.
Yeah, you can do that here. You can kind of get, you know, friendly.
Yeah, you can put your hands over your
neck. Hold hands,
you can hold hands and walk through the town. I mean, it's just a sign of friendliness.
San Francisco or maybe, you know,
more alternative cities.
More of the
But in mainstream America, if it's a sporting event, it would be accepted.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that kind of thing around sports, but not in the general.
I do forget sometimes, but around how we used to be.
Yeah, but I bet there's not too many guys up in the Mount Everest that want to hold your hand. That's a cultural thing.
That's a cultural thing to
understand, unless you're oriented to that. You know?
Yeah.
Because I think even in most Asian cultures, I know in China or Japan, public affection, any sign of between a man and woman, is frowned upon. Even if they kiss or hug on the street, you know, on a street or whatever, you know.
Yeah, even in Ghana, it's pretty much the same. You
really?
Yeah, it's like the first time when I got here, I was in my school and I saw guys kissing all over the place, and I was like, what's going on? Yeah, it's something you don't see.
Yeah, in Mount Everest, you see school.
In Ghana, you can't see. You know,
none of that, huh?
No. It doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, you know, I just, society frowned upon it, so.
Yeah, well, who's the tonic guy here to get the same issues? I mean, it's like, you know, guys and girls kiss,
yeah.
You know.
So there are some cultural differences which you were obviously prepared for. Interesting. I did want to ask you, though, you mentioned, you said that you were in school in the city in Ghana, so you had already, you were living in the city at a boarding school?
No, it was a day school.
Mm-hmm.
So I was living with a cousin of mine.
Oh.
And so every morning I walked to school back and forth like that. You know, we used to walk in. And you know, after we have after junior high school, I didn't want to, you know, continue school in my town, which is somewhere in the northern part of Ghana. So I decided to, you know, come to the city.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know that the school was a day school. I thought it was a boarding school. So when I got there, we realized it was a day school. So luckily we had a relative who was my cousin. And she lives like 30 minutes away from the school.
Mm-hmm.
So did you walk 30?
Yeah, I walk. And so I, you know, live with her.
Yeah. How did you what do your parents do? Where do your family?
Yeah, my mom is a trader. Like, she buys stuff from farmers and then sells them. And then my dad is a driver. That's what they do.
And you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I have a brother. He's like probably 21.
a little bit older than yourself.
Yeah, he's older than me. But he's not in school.
You're 18 now, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm
18. That's great. Yeah, do you feel we're never out of the country, but what was the first thing that struck you when you came to the country? What was the first thing that overwhelming thing that you saw that?
Yeah, over here the only time you see Africa or Ghana is when there is disease or when there is civil war or this kind of stuff. But in Ghana or Africa it's very different. Most of the times when you see the U.S. is mostly in New York City. And you see hip-hop stars, singing, Ja Rule, Jay-Z and stuff. And so, that is what we have in our mind, You're thinking you're going to a place where you have hip-hop stars or you have tall buildings and stuff. And so when I got here, when we got to New York City, when we landed at JFK, I'm seeing the same thing. But after we left Washington, D.C., this place, it was very different. And, I didn't expect to see parts of the U.S. like this, very isolated.
Oh,
and
up here, yeah.
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 I was expecting tall buildings. And
but this is this is mostly what New England's like.
Yeah.
And most of the country, really, is small towns, a lot of small rural.
Yeah, we don't see that on TV. And so I was... When I left Washington D.C., I met my first host family. That was at Albany, and so we drove to Great Barrington, and they were like, "We'll live somewhere here." I was like, "What's going on?" And
where are we going?
I was kind of like,
I just have to change the tape side.
In front of your house, you go chat to somebody. But, over here, everybody is in his house, in his room. I was like, what's going on? So I sometimes take a walk, trying to see if there's somebody, outside. But you don't see anybody.
Really?
Yeah. People are almost pretty much in their houses, in their rooms and stuff.
That's true. But the weather is not
yeah, I came in the summer, though.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
And, And right now, I think, I'm used to everything here.
I know that you were practicing for a talent show. Did that come up yet? did you do that yet?
Yeah, I'm planning on it.
Oh, it's not yet. It's coming.
It's not yet. Yeah, it's somewhere, I think, first May.
Oh,
yeah, it's been postponed, yeah.
Oh, okay. So I know you had a song you were going to do.
Yeah, a song,
you're going to do... Now, the unique thing of that was you were going to do the song. It wasn't a hip-hop song, but it was a Ghana song. But you were Ghanaian.
Yeah, Ghanaian song.
And you were going to do it in English.
Yeah.
Did that work out, or did you get that down, or...?
Yeah, I'm making progress, Yeah.
You want to try it on the air?
Not now.
Because I remember you were saying a little bit about it. If I really wanted to know there, it sounded pretty good. But you're going to be ready for that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
I hope so. Yeah.
Yeah, I forget when that is. It's a Mount Everett. Is when is that? The 15th or something? Or
right now it's first May.
First of May.
Yeah.
That's gonna be up at Mount Everett. A big talent show up there.
Mm-hmm.
For all the
wicked awesome.
Yeah. Wicked awesome. I got a lot of talented people up there. A lot of talented kids.
Oh yeah, we got Shakespeareans.
Yeah.
Musicians.
Poets and some
the Licks, the Licks.
Licks, yeah. those guys are real good. But so what are you now? I know you're gonna be when you go back to Ghana, which is like this is your year. You're gonna graduate here and then you're gonna go back.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Now, I just wanted to ask before you're gonna graduate. Will you get a diploma from Mount Everett, or do you get one from your school at home? How does that work?
I was thinking of getting a diploma, but I don't think I can get it here. Yeah, I spoke to a guidance counselor one time ago, and she was like, no, we don't give diploma to
exchange
students.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, okay. So if you pass everything here, then you get one from there, a certificate of completion.
Yeah, right now I'm looking into schools and hoping to get into a college,
Yeah.
And if that happens, then I might come back. But
can you do you think you can come back?
Yeah, if I get a good scholarship to a good college.
Yeah.
That's why you're studying for the SAT.
Oh, yeah.
do you have your eye on some place that you'd like to go, or have you looked
at it? Yeah, Manhattanville.
Mm-hmm.
And then AIC, American International College.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, yeah, the two.
Yeah, those are quite good schools.
Mm-hmm.
What would you like to major in? What are you?
Law.
Law?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. International, or you like to go to American law, be an American lawyer?
International.
International, yeah.
Maybe I can combine both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. Now, so where are you? Are you going to be? It's going to be quite anticlimactic going back, but there's going to be a lot expected of you.
Yeah.
When you do go back, right?
Yeah, yeah.
What kind of duties or what kind of things will you be involved with the government there? Will it be an entry levels or an internships or kind of thing, or what will you be some kind of junior?
This is how it works. I mean, at the end of each year, and my coordinator can explain it better than me, at the end of each year we have what we call the alumni project,
right.
Mm-hmm. And you're supposed to kind of like share with your home nation what you've achieved during your stay in the U.S.
Yeah.
And they offer support, and the American Embassy in Ghana too is, you know, very supportive, and they help students to, you know, reach out to people in their community and then, you know, give back to society.
Your host has stated that she's also you're part diplomat, as part of a diplomatic effort to be here.
Yeah.
But there's an outreach as well. I mean, you're involved with you give speeches and you give talks to different places.
Yeah.
And so forth, right?
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to put out that contact, you know, to contact you and contact if anybody listening would like to get involved with this project or would like to have Muhammad as a guest speaker or in a school or whatever, because he's a great guy. He's a good-looking guy, too, so you don't have to worry about that.
Which I can give out your information.
He's a good-looking guy.
Yeah.
The coordinator will give out her... Leo, the coordinator will give out her information here. So if anyone was interested in just volunteering, either as a local coordinator themselves or in hosting a student or had some other interest in connecting with the students in a volunteer manner, they could certainly go to the website at www.yesprograms.org. And my name is Lelia Brune. I live in Berkshire County.
Okay.
And one could contact me as well.
Would you like your email? You want to give your email?
Sure, I'm happy to. My email is lakbrune, BRUUN, @yahoo.com.
Okay. And,
Leo, I also wondered, we have exchange students coming from these countries to the United States. I did see a brochure that said we have them going the other way, from here to Ghana and
right.
Thailand and Egypt and India. Are you involved with that endeavor as well?
I am. I actually, this fall was the first opportunity. In February was the deadline for applications. I mean, that was the whole point of this program, is to really close that circle in full and make it complete, where our own students now have the opportunity to travel to 7 of the countries. We had 5 scholarships per country, so we had a total of 35 scholarships.
I mentioned the countries, which were Egypt, Ghana, India, Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, and Turkey. I have on there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all these.
I have students in 3 of those countries here in Berkshire County.
Really?
Wow.
Muhammad being from Ghana, I host a student from India, and I have a student from Thailand. You know, information was sent to each of the high schools, and I, again, reached out. But I think it's a process of cultivating our students. I think traditionally we tend to go to countries that are more developed, but I think our country acknowledges the really need that we have to develop an ability to understand and
serve
differently.
And how do you find, for coming from a Muslim country, or is Ghana all mostly a Muslim, or is it?
Ghana is mostly Christianity.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, but we have fairly large percentage of Muslims in Ghana.
Okay.
Yeah.
Coming from that background to here, which is everything.
Yeah, it's a combination of
like
different stuff. Yeah.
How did you adjust to that? It's kind of like people not, you know, just being very different in their religious ideas.
Yeah, it's like you said, it's very different.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, you know, you don't get to pray in a mosque, and you don't pray on time. That's for sure. And you know, those are some of the challenges, you know, you have to face.
Right.
Mm.
Was it hard for you not to pray to Mecca at the appointed times, which we don't do in this country? And
yeah,
it's very hard when you're used to doing that.
You know, in Ghana, we time is very useful, but mostly we depend on what we call the azan, the one who calls for prayer.
Right.
You know, we pray five times a day.
Yeah. The mosques, yeah.
Yeah, and so most of the times we depend on him to, you know, call to prayer, so we know it's time, but over here you don't hear anything, and most of the time you're busy.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
You know, let's see, look. But what are the times that you call for? Is it like noon and... Well,
yeah, we pray...
It's five times a day, right?
Yeah, we call it dawn. That is somewhere 5 o'clock in the morning, and then somewhere 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and then somewhere 3:30 in the afternoon, and then 6 o'clock in the evening, and then 7 o'clock.
And how long do the prayers last? Like, is there a time limit, or is
it varies from
person to person.
Person. But probably like 10 minutes. Very short, huh?
Yeah. Well, no, it's long. I mean, I don't think that long. even in one thought, you know, 10 minutes that long, you know.
But yeah.
It's pretty scattered. Well, you know how it is. It's like,
do you have a religion?
No.
Nice.
Not really. Not in that devout sense. I believe.
Oh, all right.
I believe in a God, and one God. But I believe I don't like religions.
Oh, all right. Okay.
They make me nervous.
I understand you. Yeah.
Because they.
You don't want to be committed.
No, it's not the commitment. It's the. Like there's a lot of Christians who don't like Muslims, a lot of Muslims who don't like Christians, a lot of Christians who don't like Jews, a lot of Jews who don't like, you know what I mean? But it's all because of the religion, okay, as opposed to the person, you know? And my feeling is that God created everybody, all right? God's one, all right? And the idea is to go back to the one, okay? And anything that stops that or prevents that or hinders that process, I don't agree with. Okay.
Yeah, but I think that is those who hate each other because of
religion. Yeah.
Religion is, I think, is
wrong.
Out of ignorance.
Oh.
Not even wrong. It's out of ignorance because when you go to Islamic, when you go to Christianity, when you go to even the Jews, you know, their doctrine never says you should hate somebody who is outside your, you know, religious boundary.
But the very strangest thing about all of this, about all these major religions other than Buddhism and others, but anything that's of a Jewish, Judeo, it was a Judeo and then Christian and then Muslim. I mean, these were all prophets from the same religious stream, you know, from the same prophets.
Well, we all believe in one God.
I mean,
you know.
So but the odd thing is they're the ones that fight each other the most, you know. So as far as I'm concerned, one God, one thing, no religion, no hats, no shirts, no vestments, no nothing.
Yeah.
You know, you are who you are.
That,
I accept you as you are. You don't want to kill me.
That is why I'm here.
I don't want to kill you. I'm a happy man.
That is why I'm here to, you know.
Yeah.
Bridge those gaps.
Right.
Reach out to everybody, Christian, Jewish, even Muslims, to reach out to everybody, you know. It's out of ignorance, and the only way we can overcome that is through education. And
that's true.
That's why we are here, to learn from each other and then try to bridge those gaps and remind ourselves of the fact that we have duty to our God, the one we serve, and our children and the next generation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you there. There we have a duty in the world and to the higher, always the highest and the best. you know.
Yeah.
That's
well, I can tell that you're making a fine ambassador from your country.
Thank you.
And I hope you get a chance to speak to students from other schools besides Mount Everest. I hope that people take advantage of listening to you.
Yeah, and I hope many Americans will, you know, open their houses for, you know, students
yeah.
to share whatever they have with them, because, you know, it's very wonderful, and the best you can do right now is to welcome somebody into your family and learn from him whilst he learns from you, and,
yeah.
you know, it's just blessing, and, you know, at the end of the day, you all become happy and proud of each other,
yeah.
and I think that's the most important thing.
I think you're right.
And it's the YES programs.
Yeah, the YES.
What?
YES, Youth
Study. Yeah, YESprograms.org. And I wanted to mention it, but we ran out of time, but the fresh air thing, that maybe we can do another show on that. Okay, later on and bring one of your fresh air kids. But we'd love to, Muhammad, it's been a real pleasure to have you.
Thank
but
you.
We're going to do something very American here.
All right.
To end the show, because we always do it.
Uh-huh.
And, I don't know if you got to be familiar with Roy Rogers and Dale Evans, because we always finish our show for the last 6 years with Happy Trails. So you can follow along. I know you got a good singing voice, so we're going to do this.
Oh, yeah.
And he goes, yeah, I'll tell you the lyrics quickly. Mm-hmm. Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you, keep smiling until then. Happy trails to you till we meet again. That's the abridged song. That's what we
think. Oh, all right, nice.
So, you ready?
Ready? Uh-huh.
We're ready.
Okay.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you, keep smiling until then. Happy trails to you till we meet again.
There you go.
Hey.
That's an all-American song.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't get more American.
And thanks for choosing the L.A. Steel Show on Tuesday night from 8 to 10. Please choose it again next week. We look forward to sharing with you our adventures, news, and our special guests.
The Adventures of Lila and Leo, yes. So we're gonna leave you now, and we'll be back next week at the same time. And please join us. I hope you had a good time, and thank you, Muhammad. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Lila. Absolutely.
And we'll talk later. Okay, and a good night.
Good night, folks.
What's that sound? Everybody, what's going down?
You've been listening to the L.A. Steel Talk Radio Show. Join us here again every Tuesday night, 8 to 10 p.m. on Q103.3.
The opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of the management, staff, or advertisers of Q103.
All right. I got about a minute remaining. I hope you enjoyed that. That was Muhammad Adewale. I hope he got his name properly pronounced there. And his coordinator. Lila Brun. So thank you very much. Hope you enjoyed the show, and talk to you next week. You can join us, please, tomorrow night and Friday night with George Dixon when we talk about metaphysics and esoteric knowledge. I'll be completing the Wonders of Ocean, the lecture by Manly P. Hall tomorrow. So please join us at 8 o'clock. And thank you and good night.